and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you to the fourth in the spring series of the Vancouver Institute. This evening, it's a real pleasure to introduce Professor Mabel Colbeck. I hope you'll forgive me if I do this on a slightly personal note. I realize that Dr. Colbeck and I have been associated with this university for quite some time, and it's over 25 years since I first heard her present a talk on the subject of the ballad, and I date my own interest in the subject from that time. She is not only a scholar, but I think you will find that her presentation is a joy to the ear as well. Now, our format will be slightly different this evening in that we have, if you like, a bonus. Professor Ruby Nemser, also of the Department of English, will be singing some of the selections which Professor Colbeck will discuss. And for that reason, the presentation will go slightly longer than usual, and we will forego the normal question period. With that explanation of our organizational plans for this evening, it's a great pleasure to introduce Professor Colbeck.
Thank you, Professor. I wonder if you're all looking with some slight dismay at this rather formidable bundle of papers I have here. As I survey them, I'm reminded of one of my father-in-law's favorite stories. He was a minister of the Church of Scotland, I might add. And the story went like this. It used to be the custom in the north that when a living went vacant, aspiring young clergy would be invited to give a trial sermon. In the front row always sat three elderly women who listened unblinkingly to the hapless candidates. Their rapt attention misled one brash young man. At the end, he accosted them. "How did it go?" he asked. "Well," said the spokeswoman, "it had only three faults." "Indeed," he said eagerly. "And what were they?" "Well, in the first place, you read it. And in the second place, you didn't read it well. And in the third place, it wasn't worth reading." To the first of these charges, I plead guilty tonight. And I would also like to add that, like Montaigne, I bring here but a nosegay of culled flowers. Nothing is my own but the thread that ties it. Despite the ambition and breadth of the title, my aim is a very modest one. It's simply to follow the advice of the great Dr. Johnson, who said that men more often need to be reminded than informed. And T.S. Eliot has told us that Dr. Johnson's a dangerous man to disagree with. So I'm going to begin by saying that what I want to remind you of this evening is the relevance of songs and ballads in our lives. Some of us today may never read a word of poetry or listen to an old song. But I want to establish the idea that for at least one period in our lives, no matter how brief that period, we have loved the musical sound of rhyming words and found delight in rhythmical measures, even if we've long forgotten the pleasure we once had in the magic syllables of nursery rhymes. "Girls and boys come out to play, the moon doth shine as bright as day. Little Jack Horner sat in a corner." There are scores of them. Not that all nursery rhymes are poetry, though they happen to be in rhyme, nor does a child recognize a good poem when he hears it. This takes experience, discrimination, and maturity. What I am claiming here is that the first mother who crooned pleasant sounds over the head of a sleepy child realized, no matter how subconsciously, the power of words and rhythm to charm and satisfy. Ars longa vita brevis. Art is long, life is fleeting. No art is longer than the composition of poetry, probably the first art our race delighted in, as a woman crooned her first melody. But all too soon, somewhere along the line, the spell breaks, the magic disappears, and poetry ceases to charm, and the adult realizes, sometimes with regret, sometimes with indifference, that he has lost the wonderful art of being able to appreciate poetry, but not entirely. I'd like to suggest tonight that whether we recognize it or not, songs and ballads have always been intimately relevant to our lives, and they're timeless. Here's a little 18th century French-Canadian folk song about a lover lamenting the fact that his mistress no longer loves him. He finds the summer day too warm, so he jumps into a convenient fountain to get cool, but keeps on singing most melodiously. Here is the clear fountain.
Oh, la claire fontaine, mon allant promener, j'ai trouvé l'eau si belle que je m'y suis baigné. Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai. Sous les feuilles d'un chêne, je me suis fait sécher. Sur la plus haute branche, le rossignol chantait. Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai. Chante, rossignol, chante, toi qui as le cœur gai. Tu as le cœur à rire, moi je l'ai à pleurer. Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai. J'ai perdu ma maîtresse sans l'avoir méritée. Pour un bouquet de roses que je lui refusais. Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai. Je voudrais que la rose fût encore au rosier, et moi et ma maîtresse dans les mêmes amitiés. Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai.
Throughout recorded time, poetry has been the art that includes all others in its techniques, as the songwriters, the makers, as they were called in medieval times, paint pictures, make music, recount history, utter prophecies, and produce philosophy and theology. They inflame to war and persuade to peace, all by the mysterious power of words. Great poets know this. Yeats did when he cried, "Know that I would accounted be true brother of a company that sang to sweeten Ireland's wrong, ballad and story, ran and song." Or Robert Burns, when he said, "E'en then a wish, I mind its power, a wish that to my latest hour shall strongly heave my breast, that I, for poor old Scotland's sake, some useful plan or book could make, or sing a song at least." You'll note that both men feel strongly about the power of poetry to sweeten life or help men to endure it. A Scotsman once said, "If a man were permitted to make all the ballads, he need not care who should make the laws of a nation." There's some truth in that statement. These ballad singers or makers were the storytellers, the news vendors, the gossips. They took the place of all the news media we have today, and whether they knew it consciously or not, they were, to put it crudely, the brainwashers. those entertainers who have made the songs and ballads of the people for hundreds of years. I've been looking at volume 4 of the superb collection called The History of France in Song. Reaching back to the Middle Ages, this collection presents a history of France as vividly as if it were depicted in tapestries being unrolled before us. Included are broadsides, street ballads, folk songs, children's rhymes, and classical melodies. I know of no other comparable musical history of a people, but certainly others could be compiled by assiduous researchers. Scholars and critics, as well as historians, have gleaned a great deal of knowledge of the value our forefathers lived by in studying the songs of a country. Sometimes the results of the studies have been surprising. How many children for centuries have happily chanted, "London bridges falling down, London bridges falling down, my fair lady," without ever having heard the rather sinister significance of that pleasant jingle, a jingle heard in several European countries with the name of the town changed. Do you remember how it goes? Two children join hands to form an arch, beneath which the others all troop in a line, singing. At a certain point in the song, the two form the arch, bring their arms down round a certain child, who's thus taken prisoner and temporarily put out of the game. Today, we know that the rhyme is associated with a very ancient, widespread superstition. It was believed that rivers always have an especial antipathy towards the erection of bridges and brought every kind of opposition to prevent the builders from succeeding. To propitiate the angry river gods, a human sacrifice, generally a child or young person, would be offered, being buried alive beneath the first stone to be set. It's obvious that throughout the long passage of time, many nursery rhymes have undergone great changes, which make some of them meaningless to us, particularly the refrains, but often even the very simple ones have a sense of excitement, of heightened sensibility, which have kept them alive for centuries. The step from nursery rhymes to ballads and folk songs is not a difficult one. They are both what Addison in 1710 called the darling songs of the people, adding, as was customary with him, a stern admonition, which I now repeat with equal sternness. An ordinary song or ballad that is the delight of the common people cannot fail to please all such readers as are not unqualified for the entertainment by their affectation or ignorance. So there. The term ballad has been used to describe any poem in short stanzas which tell a story. Folk songs do this too. Many scholars accept as a satisfactory definition of a folk song that it's a song that has been transmitted orally, that is, learnt by word of mouth, by one generation from another, without the assistance of the written word. This definition can also apply to ballads. I'm speaking, of course, of artistic forms and not scientific categories. But the great distinguishing feature in a ballad is its particular way of telling a story, a narrative technique which has been compared to the modern comic strip, where the eye is led from each clearly depicted scene to the next with dialogue, not description, filling in the story. In other words, not the thing told, but the way of telling it. It can be seen then that purely oral transmission, the mark of a true folk ballad, can exist only among an entirely illiterate community with little contact with book learning. I know of only one genuine modern ballad, that is, one that has all the marks of the true ballad. No matter how unlike the traditional ballad, the language and the protagonists appear. The heroes and heroines of the early songs were not the simple people. They don't make history, but the great ones, the archetypes found in the romances of chivalry. Nevertheless, in the ballad I'm going to read now, The characters are hardly... Well, here's the ballad. Frankie and Johnny were lovers. Oh, Lordy, how they could love. Swore to be true to each other, true as the stars above. He was her man, but he done her wrong. Johnny's mother told him, and she was mighty wise, don't spend Frankie's money on that parlor, Annie Lies. You're Frankie's man, and you're doing her wrong. Frankie went down to the pawn shop. She bought herself a little 44. She aimed at the ceiling, shot a big hole in the floor. Where is my man? He's doing me wrong. Frankie went down to the hotel, looked in the window so high. There she saw her loving Johnny, a loving up Alice Bly. He was her man, but he done her wrong. Johnny saw Frankie a-coming. Down the back stairs he did scoot. Frankie had the little gun out, let him have it, rooty de toot. But he was her man, and she shot him down. Oh, bring 1,000 policemen, bring him round today. Oh, lock me in that dungeon and throw the keys away. I shot my man, 'cause he done me wrong. Yes, put me in that dungeon, oh, put me in that cell. Put me where the northeast wind blows from the southeast corner of hell. I shot my man, 'cause he done me wrong. Frankie mounted to the scaffold, as calm as a girl can be, and turning her eyes to heaven, she said, good Lord, I am coming to thee. He was my man, and he done me wrong. That was a greatly abbreviated version, but the marks are all there. The anonymity, the dramatic action, the repetition of epithets, the rapid working out of the plot, no extraneous material, and of course, the old familiar story of the faithless lover, which occurs in 100 traditional ballads. I would like to add Frankie and Johnny to Child's famous collection of the 305 traditional ballads. But perhaps I am on safer ground with the song which so delighted Mr. Pepys in 1666 when he heard a charming actress singing Barbara Allen's Cruelty. The story is told in 20 different versions, depending on which country it's found in. Since Pepys heard it in London, it went like this.
In Scarlet Town, where I was born, there was a fair maid dwelling. Many youth cry well away. Her name was Barbara Allen.
If you'd heard it in Scotland, it would have been called Barbara Allen and would go like this.
It was in and about Martinmas time, when green leaves were falling, that Sir John Graham in the West Country fell in love with Barbara Allen.
Today in Kentucky, the children sing still another version, this time called Barbary Allen.
All in the merry month of May, when green buds there were swelling, young William Green on his deathbed lay, for love of Barbary Allen.
In the Scots version, the poor lover dies at Martinmas, which occurs in the sad month of November. But it's probably still sadder to have him die in the merry springtime as he does in the Kentucky song. It's difficult to estimate the pervasive quality of this handful of simple and splendid poetry which make up the ballads. The very fine ones all achieve the mood of sadness that's characteristic of tragic stories derived from ancient folklore or frequently from historical events. 400 years ago, that scholar, soldier, and poet, Sir Philip Sidney, confessed his feelings on hearing the old ballad Chevy Chase, sung by a blind fiddler. He said, I never heard the old song of Percy and Douglas, that I found not my heart moved more than by a trumpet. Other versions of the one Sidney listened to are the Battle of Otterburn and the hunting of the Cheviot, but all are concerned with the same bloody battle which took place in the 14th century between the English under Earl Percy and the Scots under the Earl of Douglas. It's a tale of extraordinary bravery and heroic deeds, and the ballad is lifted to dramatic intensity when the teller speaks about Earl Douglas. The night before the battle, the Scots were resting, not believing the English were ready to attack. But at dawn, Douglas awoke, heavy-hearted, saying, "Ah, he dreamed a dreary dream. Beyond the Isle of Skye, I saw a dead man win a fight, and I think that man was I." He and Percy did meet that day in single combat, and Douglas was killed. The battle went to the Scots, however, and Percy was taken prisoner. Neither this ballad nor any of the others I wish to speak about were set down in print before the beginning of the 18th century. And we owe to the early ballad collectors a great debt for the work they did in taking down words and music from people who had them only in memory. No wonder so many versions exist. Sir Walter Scott used to go around the countryside collecting old songs or fragments of them, and rumor has it that he would walk 40 miles there and back to interview an ancient woman who was said to know still another ballad. He didn't always fare well. His biographer tells us that he was severely scolded by one elderly lady who said, "There were never yin of my sangs printed till you printed them yourself, and ye spoilt them altogether. They were made for singing and no for reading, but ye hae broken the charm new, and they'll never be sung mair." Fortunately, Margaret Laidlaw was wrong. They are both read and sung. The ballad you're going to hear now is from the annals of Scottish history. In it, the marks of the true ballad are easily recognized. Its best-known title is Mary Hamilton, though you may know it as the Queen's Mary's. It's one of the most popular Scottish songs and shows much of the Scottish temperament. Haunting in its music and the stark, simple understatement at the end, "The nicht shall hae but three." There's no moralizing, no explaining. The historian who recorded this event was, not very fittingly, a man who hated ballads and gay ladies, and most of all, hated Mary Queen of Scots and her four Marys. John Knox is the writer who tells the story in his volume, The History of the Reformation, and he records there with grim satisfaction that justice was done. In the ballad, Mary Hamilton cries, "Oh, often have I dressed my queen and put gold in her hair, but now I've gotten for my reward the gallows to be my share." Knox's version has the Queen's apothecary as Mary Hamilton's faithless lover, but in the variation you're about to hear, Lord Darnley, the Queen's gay young husband, is the man who should share Mary Hamilton's fate. The version Ruby will sing is slightly abridged.
Word's gone to the kitchen, and word's gone to dear hall, that Mary Hamilton gangs with them to the highest steward of all. She's tied it in her apron, and she's thrown it in the sea. Say, sinky, swimmy, bonny wee babe, ye'll ne'er get mare of me. Down and come the good queen, gold tassels tie in her hair. Oh, Mary, where's the bonny wee babe that I her greet sae sair? Oh, Mary, put on your robes of black, or else your robes of brown. For ye maun gang with me the nicht to see fair Edinburgh toon. nor yet my robes of prune, but I'll put on my robes of white to shine through Edinburgh toon. When she come doon the cannon gate, the cannon gate say free, many a lady looked o'er her window weeping for this lady. You need no weep for me, she says, you need no weep for me, for had I not slain mine own sweet babe, this death I would not die. Last night I washed the queen's feet and gently laid her down, and all the thanks I've gotten the night to be hanged in Edinburgh toon. Last night there was four Maries, the night there be the three, there was Mary Seton and Mary Beaton and Mary Carmichael and me.
Another important ballad in Scottish history concerns an event during the reign of Mary's son, James VI. It's a lament for the death of a handsome young man. Robertson's History of Scotland tells us that the Earl of Murray was a young nobleman of the most promising virtues and the very darling of the people. The event took place in February 1592, and we're told was immediately much talked about to the discredit of the participants. The ballad, The Bonnie Earl of Murray, has kept the tale alive. As are so many of the really fine songs, it's the last act of a tragedy. King James commissioned the Earl of Huntly to find Murray and bring him to court on a charge of having conspired against the king. Murray, incidentally, was a cousin of the infamous Bothwell who had married Mary, Queen of Scots. It was whispered that James's Queen Anne of Denmark admired the young gallant, which was perhaps as serious a cause for the king's displeasure as the conspiracy charge. Murray wasn't brought to court, but was set upon by the king's men in ambush. Gordon of Bucky in the fight wounded Murray in the face, whereupon Murray raised himself from the ground on one arm and said, Gordon, you've sport a better face than your own. At this, Gordon, perhaps in regret or shame, turned on Huntly, the leader of the attackers, and said, you'll be in this as deep as I, and forced him at dagger's point to run his sword through Murray's defenseless body.
Ye Hielands and ye Lowlands, oh, where hae ye been, and laid him on the green? He was a braw gallant, and he played at the ring, and the bonny Earl of Murray, he micht have been a king. Lying may his lady look frae the castle doon, ere she see the Earl of Murray come sounding through the town. Why betay ye Huntly, and wherefore did ye say, I bade ye bring him wi' ye, and forbade ye him to slay? He was a braw gallant, and he played at the ball, on the bonny Earl of Murray, the floor among them all. Lang may his lady look frae the castle doon, ere she see the Earl of Murray come soon in through the town.
In the ballad world, the supernatural is commonplace. We're back with the beliefs and conventions of people who used singing and poetry as integral to their lives. These people accepted unquestioningly the vision of life as essentially tragic. The Wife of Usher's Well, a tragedy, shows the widespread idea among our ancestors that excessive grieving for the dead disturbs their rest, a remnant of pagan beliefs. Sir Walter Scott has a story of a Highlander who came back to a sorrowing kinswoman saying, "Stop weeping, your tears scald my shroud." The Wife of Usher's Well depends for its effect on the miracle which enables the dead to rise and appear before the mourner, generally to rebuke him for the obstinacy of his sorrow. The woman here has lost her three sons at sea, and in her bitter grief, she demands of fate that she see them once more in flesh and blood. She cries out recklessly, "I wish the wind may never cease, nor fascism the flood, till my three sons come home to me in earthly flesh and blood." Well, they come home, and in a few vivid and realistic pictures we see the sons. It fell about the Martinmas, when nichts are lang and mirk, the carlin wife's three sons came hame, and their hats were o' the birk. Today we'd hardly find anything very ominous in the mention of that birch which adorns the hats of the sons when they stand before their mother. But the first audience is new, and like Hamlet when he saw the ghost of his father, they knew and shuddered. No one had ever come back from the gates of paradise alive. But the mother rejoices to see her sons. "Blow up the fire, my maidens, bring water from the well, for all my house shall feast this night, since my three sons are well." And she has made to them a bed. She's made it large and wide, and she's ta'en her mantle, her aboot, sat down at the bedside. But the mother, too, if she heard it, must have known that the crowing of the cock wouldn't announce only the dawning of the day. It would warn the dead that they must not linger another hour in the land of the living. Up then crew the red, red cock, and up and crew the grey. The eldest to the youngest said, "'Tis time we're away." The cocky hadna crowed but once, and clapped his wings at awe, when the youngest to the eldest said, "Brother, we must awa'. The cock doth craw, the day doth daw, the channer and worm doth chide. Gin we be missed out o' our place, a sair pain we maun bide. Fare ye weel, my mother dear, fare weel to barn and byre, and fare ye weel, the bonny lass that kindles my mother's fire." In the understatement in this ballad, there's more poignant feeling of grief than in any number of loud outcries. Our own imaginations are aroused by suggestion, and the whole poem is thus enriched. In the last verses, the hideous mention of the channer and worm that chides makes all the stronger the feeling of loss that comes with the image of the warm life of flesh and blood, the barn and byre, the fire and the hearth, and above all, the bonny lass. They're only mentioned, but our minds are prepared for them. And the contrast between the gruesome world of the dead and warm, sensuous life is shown more vividly than by a page of prose description. So far, I've been speaking mostly about ballads. Now I want to speak about songs. I'm going to read a couple of lines of a song you all know by heart and probably have sung not too long ago. However, the verses in Japanese, you may not recognize it, particularly as my Japanese accent superimposed on a Scots one may present difficulties. Hotaru no hikari, mado no yuki, fumi yomu tsukihi, kasa ne tsutsu. That was the Japanese rendering of Auld Lang Syne. The best known song of friendship we have, and the only song of parting used in Japan today. It is this song of past pleasures and future hopes that introduced the people of Japan to the poetry of Robert Burns and led to the establishment of the Japan Caledonian Society. I admit a few changes have taken place in the translation. The second verse of the original has it, "We twa herein aboot the braes and pooed the gowans fine, but we wandered mony a weary fit sin auld lang syne." Some of you may remember the difficulties Mr. Micawber and David Copperfield had with that word gowans. Neither knew what it meant. We, of course, know that a gown is merely a rather large daisy or marguerite to be picked in any field. The Japanese translator had a problem with the gowans also. So his nostalgic memories of his happy youth go back to the light of fireflies decorating the scene. The sentiment in both cases is the same. And whether a gown or a firefly, this is truly a song of the people, almost a folk national anthem when good friends meet to part. Few people today remember the foolish song, Lillibullero, which helped to drum a king off the throne. Though, if you're a devotee of Tristram Shandy, you may remember how often poor Uncle Toby left the room humming Lillibullero when he was worsted in an argument with Uncle Toby or with anyone else. No history of Ireland would be complete without mention of this satirical ditty. It was composed near the end of the 17th century to ridicule the Irish Catholics who were united to fight for James II under a certain English General Talbot against the Protestant troops of both Ireland and England. According to a contemporary writer, this song treated the Catholics and chiefly the Irish in a very ridiculous manner. Bishop Percy in the 18th century was very eloquent. He said, "Slight and insignificant as this song may seem now, it once had a more powerful effect than either the Philippics of Demosthenes or Cicero, and contributed not a little towards the great revolution in 1688. Another writer, another bishop, testified that this foolish song made an impression on the English army that cannot be well imagined by those who saw it not. The whole army, and at last all the people in both city and country, were singing it perpetually, and perhaps never had so slight a thing so great an effect." And thus, in a pamphlet of the time, "A Deluded Prince" was sung out of three kingdoms. The words are set to a far more agreeable melody than they deserve, in that they were adapted to one of Purcell's exercises for the harpsichord. Ruby's going to sing Lillibullero.
No. Got it.
Oh, Brother T, dost hear the decree?
Whoops.
Yep. Oh, Brother T, dost hear the decree? Lillibullero, bullinola, that we shall have a new deputy. Lillibullero, bullinola. Help.
That's supposed to prevent that from happening. Aha. Found it, dude. You mind if I start all over again? Take another run at it.
Oh, Brother T, dost hear the decree? Lillibullero, bullinola, that we shall have a new deputy. Lillibullero, bullinola, lillibullero, 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 bullinola. There was an old prophecy found in a bog. Lillibullero, bullinola, our land shall be ruled by an ass and a dog. Lillibullero, bullinola, lillibullero, 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 bullinola, lillibullero, bullinola, lillibullero, bullinola. And now this prophecy is come to pass. Lillibullero, bullinola, for Talbot's the dog and James is the ass. Lillibullero, bullinola, lillibullero, 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 bullinola, lillibullero, 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 bullinola.
Thank you.
another song. Another song which made history and affected a whole nation has words not more impressive than those in Little Bolero. This is the famous or infamous revolutionary song, Saïra, sung by the populace of Paris as the heads of the aristocrats fell by the guillotine. The newspaper Le Mercure of July 1790 said, "The music and the cry of joy mingled in the countryside against the aristocrats. The refrain of most of the songs was Saïra. The aristocrats to the gibbet. Starve the aristocrats." The music was already well known to the people, though with different words. Legend has it that, ironically, the tune was a favorite of Marie Antoinette herself in happier days when she tripped to its measure in a country dance. But now not only the rabble of Paris, but all its citizens were humming words and music. Saïra is hard to translate, but in the song it means it will happen. It goes, I mean it is. The history of France and song I spoke of has half a dozen revolutionary songs, all of which were sung with fervor, and the effect of them on the people has been described as devastating, though not all the songs were as bloody-minded as this one. Roughly translated, it promises that despotism will expire, liberty will triumph, we will have no more nobles, nor priests. Liberty everywhere will reign, and the Austrian slave will follow to the gibbet, and their infernal clique will be carried off to the devil, Saïra, Saïra, Saïra. Even in French, that little lyric can hardly be called great poetry either, but as showing the pulse of the people, it cannot be omitted from this brief survey. Like Little Bolero, it is satiric and derisive and depends for its power on shock. The people who sang it were fanatical about the tragic conditions of the time, but the cause for which the words were written has been fought and won, so the song has no longer power to hold an audience. It cannot rise above its own period in society. This is not true about the next song, no more famous than Saïra in its own day, but which, written nearly 115 years ago, lives on as a folk national anthem the people of America. Today is Lincoln's birthday, so it's particularly appropriate that Ruby should sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Julia Ward Howe's eloquent moving words are as vigorous today as they were in November 1861 when she set them down. The occasion was a visit she paid to the Union Army camp on the outskirts of the beleaguered city of Washington. A deeply religious woman, she was stirred profoundly by this experience. And widely current in the North at this time was the popular song beginning, "John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah." And John Brown was still revered as a martyr who was hanged as an abolitionist 3 years earlier. He had been convicted of, I quote, "treason and conspiring and advising with slaves and other rebels." But in the North, he was a hero. Mrs. Howe had already written several books of lyrics, but her claim to fame rests on the verses she set to the tune of John Brown's body. The melody seemed to have been created for the words. The song achieved almost instant fame, and its influence on the people of the North was enormous. Sung as a hymn in churches, it was a call to arms in the strongest terms.
Bishop.
Bishop, please.
Sorry. "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps.
I can read his righteous sentence by the dim and flaring lamps. His days marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His days marching on. He hath sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet, while God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. While God is marching on. In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea. With the glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make them free. While God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah, while God is marching on.
When that song was written, could even Abraham Lincoln have guessed that 100 years later, an all-black choir would sing it for the inauguration of a Southerner as President of the United States? The next little song is also American history, but in a very different key from the battle hymn. It too is a call to action, though not to battle. Follow the Drinking Gourd is today a Texas folk song, but when it was first sung, there was no thought of entertainment in the author's mind. The song contains fairly explicit instructions to Southern slaves on how to get from the Mississippi to Canada and freedom. It's in code, and the Drinking Gourd is the Big Dipper. Legend has it that the song was taught to Southern slaves by a sailor who traveled from plantation to plantation, posing as an itinerant painter or carpenter. The sailor had lost a leg, hence the line, left foot, peg foot, going on. The song contains a coded route to Ohio and thence to the underground way to Canada. Beginning north of Mobile, Alabama, the route follows riverbanks, passes over the divide, and follows the Tennessee River to the Ohio. The Drinking Gourd is the key to the code, that is the Big Dipper with its lip pointing to the North Star.
When the sun comes back and the first quail calls, follow the Drinking Gourd. For the old man is waiting for to carry you to freedom if you follow the Drinking Gourd. The river bank and the mighty good road, the dead trees show you the way. Left foot, peg foot, traveling on, follow the Drinking Gourd. Follow the Drinking Gourd, follow the Drinking Gourd. For the old man is waiting for to carry you to freedom if you follow the Drinking Gourd. The river ends between two hills. Follow the Drinking Gourd. Another river on the other side if you follow the Drinking Gourd. Follow the Drinking Gourd. Follow the Drinking Gourd, for the old man is waiting for to carry you to freedom if you follow the Drinking Gourd. Where the little river meets the big river, follow the Drinking Gourd, for the old man is waiting for to carry you to freedom if you follow the Drinking Gourd.
drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd. For the old man is waiting for to carry you to freedom if you follow the drinking gourd.
The next two short songs which Ruby's going to sing are part of the same history as the drinking gourd, that bleak period for a whole race of people, though the songs themselves are far from disheartened. Mary, Don't You Weep For Me is surely an attempt to set the assurance of God's love as a barrier between the slave and his pain. The spirituals, more than any other song I've yet discussed, were the pulse of that people. The great emphasis on an afterlife alleviated in some measure the reality of life as a slave, just as the singing of the song for a few brief moments lifted the singer from the grim present into the campground of the future.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. If I could, I surely would stand on the rock where Moses stood. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. God told Noah to build him an ark. Noah built the ark out of hickory bark. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. Oh, the way of evil is wide and fair. Many, many, many that perish there. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Oh, Mary, don't you weep, don't you mourn. Pharaoh's army got drowned. Oh, Mary, don't you weep. Deep river, my home is over Jordan. Deep river, Lord, I want to cross over into campground. My home is over Jordan. Deep river, Lord, I want to cross over into campground.
In this brief talk, I've drawn freely upon folk songs and ballads in an effort to show how much they are the voice of the people, not only in times of stress and revolution, but as showing characteristics and values. The last song Ruby will sing does this superbly. The legend of the Bushman in Australia, says one writer, is still cherished as the highest and most distinctive type of national character. And the old bush songs, vigorous and realistic, show the spirit of the land. The hero is often the swagman or tramp, always opposed to the forces of property and law as represented by the squatters and the police troopers. It's not surprising that Waltzing Matilda is the unofficial national song, and the jolly swagman a kind of Robin Hood hero. Both music and words have a haunting effect that stays long in the mind and are as racy and gay as the hero himself. In case, like me, you find some of the vocabulary strange, I shall give you what I found. Waltzing Matilda, unlikely as it may appear, means carrying a swag or bundle. A billabong is a water hole, and the jumbuck that was invited to go a waltzing Matilda with the swag man is a sheep he had killed.
The Antipodeans are giggling. Once a jolly swagman can buy a billabong under the shade of a coolibar tree, and he sang as he watched and waited while his billy boiled, "Oh, come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, who'll come a waltzing Matilda with me?" And he sang as he watched and waited while his billy boiled, "Who'll come a waltzing Matilda with me?" Down came a jumbuck to drink beside the billabong. Up jumped the swagman and grabbed him with glee, and he sang as he shoved that jumbuck in his tucker bag, "You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me." And he sang as he shoved that jumbuck in his tucker bag, "You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me." Up came the squatter, mounted on his thoroughbred. Down came the troopers, 1, 2, 3. "Who's that jolly jumbuck you've got in your tucker bag? You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Where's that jolly jumbuck you got in the tucker bag? You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me." Up jumped the swagman and sprang into the billabong. "You'll never catch me alive," said he, "and his ghost may be heard as you pass by that billabong. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me." And his ghost may be heard as you pass beside that billabong. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me.
Well, that ends our program. We thank you for your attention, and we will not make the mistake of the brash young man.
While it may seem in a sense superfluous, I'd like to call on Professor Robert Jordan to thank our speaker and our singer this evening. Professor Jordan.
Come between us both.
This is a very great pleasure for me. Speaking for Dr. Colbeck's former colleagues and lasting friends in the English department, all I can say is that if this represents retirement, it's something we all need. So I want to thank you for not only teaching us a great deal this evening, but delighting us in the bargain. So to you, Mabel, and to your sweet-voiced collaborator, our very warmest thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we adjourn, I'd just like to call your attention to next week's talk, which will be given by Professor J. Tuzo Wilson on earthquakes in China and elsewhere. Are they becoming more frequent? Dr. Wilson is a distinguished authority in this field, and I'm sure you will find his talk of great interest. Thank you and good evening.